slate. The 7D I have to do manually anyway.
It okay. It all right, cool.
We've all heard about the hard way to learn, John. Is there an easy way to learn?
If you begin and understand yourself thoroughly and you have a lot of raw experience, I think natural powers are released. And I do believe that all the graceful, easy learning comes from people who are comfortable inside their own skin because they understand. And people who've had a lot of early experience. And I operated on those principles, even though it was illegal in a public school setting. I set aside one full day a week. I won't get into the politics of how this was pulled off, but it was never easy, where the kids could follow their own instincts anywhere in New York City they wanted to go. One full day a week where I took them on group projects, different parts of the five boroughs in New York City that would group projects that would end up with a tangible goal, such as testing. This one might amuse the people watching this. The New York Times announced on the front page about 3 weeks before the Ed Koch, Dave Dinkins election of, let me say 1980, somewhere around there, that Dinkins was hopelessly behind by 17 points. And I had a black kid in the class come up and ask me why the city was so prejudiced. And I said, why do you say that? And he said, well, look at this. And I said, well, why do you believe that's true? Maybe that's to get you not to go and vote. I don't know, I said, but I do know that it says here in small print that they only interviewed 300 people. There's 8 million of us. I said, there's 120 people in my five classes. If each one of you do 20 interviews, and we do it according to the way you get a random distribution, and that's easy enough to find out, well, we can have many times larger sample than. So that happened. We gathered the data. We processed it. And we discovered, about a week after the Times said he hopefully was behind, that he actually was ahead by a fraction of 1 point. That's quite askew. The election came. He won in the closest race in New York history. But notice that a random group of 120 13-year-olds had produced more accurate information. The math in the statistical processing is hardly daunting for a fifth grader. You know, so why aren't the 70 million captive school children involved in, if nothing else, data gathering, since obviously it's a crucial part of commerce? You know, opinion. Well, there must be a reason they're not used that way, nor do they hear about statistical sampling until they're in college, for the most part. Why not? According to Alfred North Whitehead, one of the major mathematicians of the 20th century, other than addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division, the only crucial piece of math for everyone to learn is statistical sampling predictions, because the society, the economy is organized around those things. the politics is organized around those things. He said that in Aims of Education, which I think was published in the mid-1940s. Well, you know, 60 years have gone by, and where is it? He's hardly a radical.
Is it possible to train fleas before you break their will? And what can one learn from the gene sequencing hobbies of 11-year-olds?
I got a foundation award at a fancy hotel in Washington, D.C., oh, I guess about 15 years ago. It was certainly a while ago. And sitting next to me was an 11-year-old boy receiving the same award from the foundation. And I mean, I was tickled. Here's this little skinny Chinese kid, and he has made some scientific breakthroughs. So, you know, I'm patronizing him the way I've been trained to do. And I said, well, how did you learn to sequence genes, you know, instead of swimming? I'm a swimming champion. I remember he said that to me. I have a lot of metal. So he was a well-balanced 11-year-old kid. And these days I understand he's a college professor in Seattle. But in any case, he said, my uncle or my grandfather explained to me that the way you train fleas, he hit a soft part in me because I used to go to Hubert's Flea Circus on 42nd Street and watch fleas draw Roman chariots and swing on trapezes. He said, you've got to break their spirits. If you put fleas in a container, they'll instantly leap off and head off in all directions because they have flea agendas, and even they don't haul off in the same direction. They have individual agendas. So he says, you gotta break that autonomy in the flea first. And the way you do that is you put them in a container, small, with a lid on, and the fleas keep attempting to follow their own agenda. And they strike themselves over and over again. And if you come back in an hour or so, they're all huddled in a mass together. Now when you take the lid off, they don't even try to escape. Now, he said, you can impose your will on the flea. The minute the 11-year-old kid said that to me, I knew that I had been hired as the lid on the container. Not that I hadn't sabotaged it somewhat, but nevertheless, that's what we all had been hired to do. And this principle was understood. Training fleas was a delight of emperors thousands of years ago. And whoever trained those fleas understood the principle and saw that it could be applied, as it is in military training, to human beings, as it is in much religious training. Not all, but much.
So you've got a character like Wundt, who believes that children have no soul, and he's designing an education system, and then you've got these Machiavellian techniques being layered in on top of it of how to break the will of animals, and it's being used to train our children.
Yeah, what's surprising is that these insights and even these activities that don't depend on modern technology. I mean, these are understood a long time ago. And the only subject at the Roman Collegia in the 5th century was, I'll put an umbrella over it, crowd control. You know, how you divide to conquer, what buttons on the human organ you press to produce certain sounds. I mean, that's 16 centuries ago. What has happened in the intervening 16 centuries? They forgot that, or was it added to? Has it become amazingly sophisticated? Less and less people necessary to produce more and more leverage.
Is there a connection between the ideals of someone like Calvin and his espousing a theocratic state and modern states like Israel, which are also built along the same theocratic terms?
I think, and I'm trying to be as fair as possible to the villains in this, I think there's some impulsion in everyone to have certainty that even as babies we're aware of how many accidents, how much menace is out there, jeopardy, certainty. So to follow a list of rules, algorithms, you know, is emotionally very satisfying, but it doesn't work if everyone's not doing it. You know, and the minute everyone's doing it, you don't have to do it. You now are handed freedom because the menace has been reduced of other people experimenting with humanity, enlarging its boundaries. And then economically, of course, your capital's at risk if that's the overproduction thing. I hope we talked about that yesterday. Because it finally was the tipping point in the late 19th century as corporations were enlarging and layering themselves. Men like Carnegie and Rockefeller and Astor, they were fully aware that human ingenuity was a tremendous risk to capital formation, because to talk people out of their wealth on the grounds that you can multiply it doesn't work if too many people invent ways to do something better than your investment. You know, the capital's destroyed. So the easiest way to manage the future and the present, of course, they saw a series of financial crises all through history, but especially in the 19th century, where the boot of the master had been lifted off ordinary people, and they were recklessly inventive. I mean, America's producing more inventions than all the rest of the world put together. You can't have that, because on that new base, the next base is going to be frightening. So a term existed and exists, but it's been camouflaged in the 21st century, called overproduction. You have to use government to control overproduction, dumping too many goods or services on the market that it can't absorb. And the easiest way to do that, at first you try licensing, you know, and other kinds of government subsidy to favored groups. But ultimately, the killer app is to remove the ability to be inventive from the ordinary mass. These days it's called overcapacity, because to penetrate what that means is much harder than to see instantly what overproduction means. Then a second menace emerged in the late 19th century, but by the late 1960s, it was clear it too would have to be controlled. That's called hyper-democracy. If too many people take democracy seriously and understand how to form alliances with one another to confront power with power, then power becomes much less effective. So when the kids stopped the Vietnamese War, waves of them, I mean, this was so intolerable. The cost to privileged classes of this reign of money, the cost to the government of not being able to suppress dissent on the grounds that this is an emergency, This couldn't be allowed to happen again. The Trilateral Commission gave me the break I needed to understand this more precisely. They underwrote the publication of a book called The Crisis of Democracy in 1975, published by New York University Press, in which you have to have training in reading between the lines, because the sophisticated power brokers aren't nakedly making these statements. But if you read Crisis of Democracy carefully, you will see that the crisis is too many people took it seriously and translated the principles into action and cost the industries and the hierarchy a war that, you know, now the next war would be harder to run. I mean, to get together. It would be more absurd. At least you could make a case in those jungles, but now you're going to have to make a case in the arid deserts of Iraq or in the mountains of Afghanistan, why national security depends on suppressing these barefoot people and people whose weapons are blowing up their feet in their underwear. Hey, you know, they're going to take the bread out of your family's mouth. I remember the attempt in Nicaragua under the Sandinistas to communicate the idea that it was just a stone's throw from our southern border, and these people might pile into their 20 and 30-year-old vehicles, and that'd be this thousand-mile drive north, and into Texas they'd come. Well, you know, we our economy, of course, cannot function without warfare. So that when these things are over, count on the fact that if we have to attack the South Pole, the penguins will are clear and present danger.
In the Paris Peace Conference, 1919, pre-CFR formation, Colonel House and these characters are hanging out, and Ho Chi Minh comes in and says, "We want to be free like America. We love democracy. We want to do this." And instead of helping them out, helping them to become free, they're like, well, we're going to have to take them out. That makes a good place to have
a war. We need enemies. We have to have enemies. The interesting thing about the book, The Crisis of Democracy, is that spreading out like ripples from a stone thrown in a pond, the popular magazines and press, Time Magazine did a cover story on too much democracy, Of course, they concluded, you bet, in a complicated high-tech world, you can't allow non-experts to make decisions there. But it was everywhere. So the tom-toms, they're interconnected, and they beat simultaneously or nearly so.
What's the role of curiosity?
Well, is it not the lever that produces invention? I mean, it forces you really, in a fun way, to think for yourself there. And then it turns out that the secrets of nature or society aren't really very hard to penetrate, as long as you remain curious. How do you destroy curiosity? Because we all say little babies are always curious. How do you destroy curiosity? Well, one good way is to sit people in chairs, tell them to speak when you're spoken to, threaten them with upcoming tests if they don't memorize usually erroneous material. It's fascinating. Show me a school book that deals with Admiral Perry's opening of Japan. And the school book, last one I looked, was nominally under the aegis of the Librarian of Congress, so a major scholar. And it will say that Essentially, it will say that we decided that Japan should be part of the modern world. It wasn't fair to leave them in medieval. And so Admiral Perry sailed over there and negotiated, and they said, okay, you can have coaling bases, or we'll take care of sunken whaler crews. What no one says is that Perry had 11-inch naval rifles, the standard of the day. The Japanese had medieval cannon with a range of about 75 yards, and Perry's guns could reach 10 miles. And that Perry emphasized the destructive impact of his force of three black gunboats. I mean, somebody had to actually paint the boats black by destroying some structures on the shore. Then they rowed out fast enough and said, you know, please, Massa.
When did the American dream become one of lifelong servitude and debt and slavery?
It's so fascinating that the American dream is enunciated in 1859 by Abraham Lincoln speaking to the Wisconsin Agricultural Associations. That's 152 years ago. And he says the American dream is to write your own script, to have an independent livelihood. That's why we don't have giant corporations like Britain and Germany have. People only work for somebody else long enough to put a stake together, and they figure out what people need, and then they do. So the American dream was, as elementary school books, it was liberty, freedom, personal sovereignty, and it was rather unique in the history of political nations around the earth, or even tribal bodies. And did it work? It almost immediately propelled us into a paramount position among the, just because there's a, I'm not hostile to, but I'm also a stranger to IT and the high-tech world, but I do try to keep up with the theory of what's going on. And about 3 or 4 years ago, there was a wonderful analytical book called The Cathedral and the Bazaar. Are you familiar with it?
I don't remember who wrote it.
At all. And I read it and I saw almost immediately what I thought nature was about proving itself through IT. The author or authors maintain that the crowd collectively has more wisdom and insight collectively, and gave some hair-raising examples. A huge gold ore body in Canada was discovered by the company putting its limited, it knew that there had to be an ore body there, but it also knew that if it used the normal procedures and the hole proved dry, excuse the mixed metaphor there, that they would be exhausted and they would have to sell what they knew. It's Goldcorp today, GG on the exchange. So how did they discover the ore body? Instead of going to the recognized engineers and blowing all their wad on one shot, on the internet, they globally put out to anyone at all, from any background at all, they wanted a theory of how to find that ore body. And somebody who had nothing to do with mining, pick up the book, because I'm losing the richness of the details.
But it's the essence of how non-experts can make some of the biggest discoveries.
Oh, well. There is a book, I made a note to bring up here. There's a book that used to be required reading at MIT, and maybe still would be. It's by a middle-level physicist named Robert Scott Root Bernstein. It's called Creativity. It's this thick, and the structure internally is so maddening. It's done in the form of a group discussion among different people why he did that. But eventually I forced myself to read it, and what just comes pouring out of it is how actual life world-changing discoveries are made. This is an MIT textbook. Apparently, by adding funds and assistance to a project, you almost destroy your ability to make these breakthroughs. People who have to saw ice cube trays in half to make a piece of lab equipment, et cetera, are the people who transcend the conventional. Now, that's often then taken over by a big project. One of the most recent dramatic examples, and I'm sure you can Google or whatever the search engine term is, there was two or three years ago in 60 Minutes, there was an account of a new way to treat cancerous tumors with radiation, without any side effects at all. And it had been discovered by a man in his garage who was had nothing to do with cancer research.
John Canzius is who you're talking about, right?
Who?
John Canzius?
Yes, Canzius.
And he worked in radio and television. And he
was a kid. He was an enthusiast. And he knew that if you shot radio waves through metal, that it heated up. And he wondered if it would kill a tumor but not leave the devastation that radiation does. And in fact, it did. Now, we don't have to take it on faith. The leading cancer researchers in the world said, this is a whole new ball game. You know, and some key research hospitals then took the process over. And Canzius's motivation was, he was in the terminal stages of cancer himself, and he knew that the established treatments wouldn't help him. And in fact, he was too far gone and he died. I think the thing is at UPittsburgh now, but it's some major universities. But I heard the reigning expert in the world say, this is makes all the past, you know, irrelevant. But that's a commonality. I copied some notes out of the Root Bernstein book. He said that intensive and narrow scientific training will guarantee that you never make a scientific breakthrough. You know, you can get the best Johns Hopkins, it doesn't matter. It's the narrowness of training. The people who make these breakthroughs have as wide a range of mental and physical tools as possible. They almost invariably play musical instruments, are good at languages, etc., etc. Most successful people in physics make it by going off by themselves and learning whatever they want to, not following the history of the physical sciences. What they learn from mentors is how to deal with ambiguity. But the established bodies of scientific knowledge get in the way of thinking afresh. You know, as soon as you hear these things, they're so commonsensical, you say, of course, why didn't I think of that? Just a couple more here. Virtually every scientific pioneer men like Edison, Franklin, Einstein, Planck, Maxwell, many others, had early opportunities to do absolutely independent research. All of them were in their early 20s, which has given rise to an understanding in the higher levels of the sciences that if you haven't made a major breakthrough by your middle 20s, you're not going to. What you can do is head up a project and be a bureaucrat and take credit, as many college professors do, for the discoveries of your students, but you're not going to be worth gambling on. It isn't the age in itself that limits insight. It's the imprint of rigid patterns of habits. Now, I happen to dig up a wonderful quote from William James' Psychology, I think printed in 1890, and the book given credit for establishing psychology as an academic subject. And James was, of course, he had ambivalent feelings, but he certainly was a disciple of Wundt there. Now, this is a direct quote from William James' Psychology 121 years ago. Habit is the enormous flywheel of society, its most precious agent. It alone saves the children of fortune from the envious uprisings of the poor. It alone prevents the most repulsive jobs from being deserted. It holds the miner in his darkness. It keeps different social strata from mixing. Well, I'll just complete. One of the insights of discovering that really electrified me as I was reading it is how frequently the great discovery in a scientific arena is not made by the specialists in that area, by somebody from another area completely divorced who transfers into chemistry or physics, has fresh eyes, cuts through the habits that lock the mind in place, and makes the discovery. Says, freedom and flexibility is much more valuable than planning. Insight comes only by getting out of ruts and plugging into a variety of methods. So these great truths, it isn't that we're discovering them now. We're taking them out of their burial places and saying, hey, look, wake up. You know, the world is much bigger and much different than you believe it is because you've been conditioned to believe it's that way. I have something here. I have the six purposes of schooling as laid down in 1917 by the man who Harvard named their honor lecture in education for. So far from being a fringe individual, this guy is the reason the Harvard honor lecture in education is named as it is, the Ingalls Lecture. Looks like Inglis, but it's pronounced Ingalls. And I would like to read you the six purposes of schooling. I moved heaven and earth, and it took years to find this book, just like trying to find in past years a copy of Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope. I learned about Ingalls from the 20-year president of Harvard, James Brian Conant, who was a poison gas specialist in World War I, was very inner circle of the atomic bomb project, World War II, was the High Commissioner of Occupied Germany after the war. So he wrote, oh, there must be 20 books about the institution of schooling, of which he was completely a proponent. And he's a very, very bad writer. I forced myself to read most of these books, and in one of them, he says that if you really want to know what school is about, you need to pick up the book that I'm referring to here, Principles of Secondary Education. 2 years it took me to find a copy of the book, 750 pages, tiny print, and as dull as your imagination can conceive. And furthermore, it's not until you get to the very middle of the book, in an unlabeled section, that he spills the beans. Let me spill them for you. These are the six purposes or functions, as he calls them. The first he calls the adjustive function. Schools are to establish fixed habits of reaction to authority. That's their main purpose, habits of reaction to authority. That's why school authorities don't tear their hair out when somebody exposes that the atomic bomb wasn't dropped on Korea as a history book in 1990s printed by Scott Forsman distributed, and why each of these books has hundreds of substantive errors. Learning isn't the reason the texts are distributed. So first is the adjustive function, fixed habits. Now, here comes the wonderful insight that being able to analyze a detail will give you. How can you establish whether someone has successfully developed this automatic reaction? Because people have a proclivity when they're given sensible orders to follow it. That's not what they want to reach. The only way you can measure this is to give stupid orders and people automatically follow those. Now you've achieved function one. Have you ever wondered why some of the foolish things schools do are allowed to continue? Number two, he calls it the integrating function, but it's easier to understand if you call it the conformity function. It's to make children as alike as possible, the gifted children and the stupid, as alike as possible, because market research uses statistical sampling, and it only works if people react generally the same way. The third function he calls the directive function. School is to diagnose your proper social role and then to log the evidence that here's where you are in the Great Pyramid so that future people won't allow you to escape that compartment. The fourth function is the differentiating function. Because once you've diagnosed kids in this layer, you do not want them to learn anything that the higher layers are learning. So you teach just as far as the requirements of that layer. Number five and six are the creepiest of all. Number five is the selective function. What that means is what Darwin meant by natural selection. You're assessing the breeding quality of each individual kid. You're doing it structurally because school teachers don't know this is happening. And you're trying to use ways to prevent the poor stuff from breeding. And those ways are hanging labels, humiliating labels around their neck, encouraging the shallowness of thinking, you know. I often wondered, because I came from a very, very strict Scotch-Irish culture that never allowed you to leer at a girl. Well, when I got to New York City, the boys were pawing the girls openly, and there was really no redress for the girls at all, except not showing up in the classroom. You know, high absentee rates. Well, you're supposed to teach structurally that that sexual pleasure is what you withdraw from a relationship, and everything else a waste of time and expensive. So the selective function is what Darwin meant by the favored races. The idea is to consciously improve the breeding stock. Schools are meant to tag the unfit with their inferiority by poor grades, remedial placement, humiliation, so that their peers will accept them as inferior. And the good breeding stock among the females will reject them as possible partners. And the sixth is the creepiest of all, and I think it's partly what tragedy and hope is about. It's a fancy Roman name, the propaedeutic function, because as early as Roman big-time thinkers, it was understood that to continue a social form required some people being trained that they were the custodians of this. So some small fraction of the kids are being ready to take over the project. That's the guy in the honor lecture, and it will not surprise you that his ancestors include the major general at the Siege of Lucknow in India, famous for tying the mutineers on the muzzles of the cannons and blowing them apart, or somebody who was forced to flee New York City, a churchman, because at the beginning of the American Revolution, because he wrote a refutation of Thomas Paine's Common Sense. They were going to tar and feather him. He fled and was rewarded by the British by making him the Bishop of Nova Scotia. Those are Ingalls' ancestors. So Al Ingalls is certainly, when I learned of this and wrote to Harvard asking for access to the Ingalls lecture, strike me dead, Lord, if I'm exaggerating at all, I was told, well, there is no Ingalls lecture, hasn't been for years, and we have no records. It was the same thing that happened when I discovered that Elwood P. Cubberley, the most influential schoolman of the 20th century and the bionomics genius, had been the elementary school editor of Houghton Mifflin. And I wrote Houghton Mifflin, is there any records? And they said, we have no record of anyone named Elwood P. Cubberley. Now Harvard's telling me there's no Ingalls lecture. A week passed, and I got a call from Harvard, from some obscure office at Harvard, saying, what is your interest in the Ingalls lecture? I knew that I was on thin ice. And I said, James Conant referred me in his books. to the man the Ingalls Lecture is named after, and I was wondering if I could get some background on this fellow and a list of the lectures. And in due time, I got a list of the lectures and instructions how to access the texts, but not easily. You know, enough hoops that someone who has to mow the lawn and burp the baby, you know, wouldn't jump through those hoops. I was able to prove Harper's wouldn't publish when they did the cover essay I wrote, which Lou Latham named Against School, probably after Jeremiah's Against. But I had called The Artificial Extension of Childhood, because I think that's the key mechanism at work here. So they wouldn't print the information about Coverley because Hart Mifflin denied it. It was only months afterward that I looked through my extensive library of incredibly dull books about schooling and opened in the facing page, said Elwood Coverley, editor-in-chief, elementary school, publishing arm of Houghton Mifflin. By the way, the secondary editor-in-chief was Alexander Ingalls. So you see how this cousinage, the incest, works.
If Martin Luther's idea was to cut out the middleman and teachers read books, why can't students just read books instead of going to the middleman for their information?
Well, the more highly placed the schooling is, the more likely it is that they do that. They go to primary documents. They understand how suspicious all secondary documents are. Not that they aren't useful, but to give the writer or the editorial staff the ability to shift the information. That's why in the reprints of Quigley's Tragedy and Hope, we really need some of you out there to sit with the original and sit with the reprint and make sure the key things aren't eluded on perfectly reasonable grounds that, you know, we want to shrink this down from 1,300 pages to 1,000 or whatever. Oh, it was an oversight.
We have 8 minutes, nine minutes left. I have two questions, and then we can do an informal book signing and get you out of here. What time?
Yeah, well, you should want to know what happens to an ordinary class of 13-year-olds when they get a smattering of that. I mean, as much as they can absorb in a short time. Well, many of you will have seen Strawberry Fields, the monument to the Beatles in Central Park. I don't want to pat myself on the back because I didn't much care for the Beatles and I hate using Parkland for it. But I was approached by three girls, two of them here, bitterly complaining that the community planning board had denied Yoko Ono's petition to build Strawberry Fields. And they were furious that this had been done. And I said, well, you don't have to accept their decision. They're the lowest part of the pecking order. First, according to protocol, you have to take your case to them. So we'll book you an appointment, and you lay down the reasons you want to take 3 acres of Central Park and give it to this group who could only play 3 musical chords. But I told them, whatever you want to do, including building a pistol, I'll show you how you can learn how to do that. I won't censor. So it had been voted down 45-8 by the Community Planning Board, and the Community Planning Board unanimously rejected their appeal. I said, now you want to look who has to sign off on their decision. This is not a group of local big shots. This is the Landmarks Preservation Commission. You don't get on that unless your ancestors come over on the Mayflower or you have $10 billion. I said, this is the elite of the elite. And now what you want to do is research. The names are publicly accessible, 23 of them, and I'll bet 4 or 5 of them would already be in favor of this thing. All you need is 12 of them to reject this for it to happen. So you find out who these people are and get as much biographical information. You know, IT has made this on these people, and you will find the buttons to play them like a noble organ. You know, you can find out what causes they became noteworthy for, et cetera, et cetera. And now what you're going to do, because there's 12,000 kids in this school district, is I'm going to free you from school for a month, and you're going to split up. You go from school to school, find troublemakers, and get petitions. Because what we need, because your letterhead will say committee of 5,000. We need 5,000 signatures on a petition. And you're going to write an individual letter writing campaign to each of the 23 members of the community planning board, asking them to please immortalize this group. Well, I get a phone call in the front office from someone out of class. I was 6 weeks later. And the voice on the phone says, hello, this is Yoko Ono. You know, and I thought it was one of my cockamamie friends. I said, you know, this is George Washington, Yoko. What's on your mind? Fortunately, she didn't take umbrage. Maybe didn't even hear me saying it. She said, the decision has been reversed. I want to hold a party at the Dakota for these girls. Could they be released from school? Well, I don't know, Yoko. I mean, I got a missile. So, that's one. Look at this one. Here's a 12-year-old C student from... he lived in Hawaii. He was a C student, but he's a polite young fellow. He was going nowhere there, and he had the effrontery to go to a pizza parlor in all-white Upper West Side in 1980, and the owner of the parlor, a 6'6" crazy Greek who happened to be a friend of mine, took his pizza, took his soda, threw them away. The charge was he had taken 2 straws. You only allow 1 straw, right? So he comes over ranting about racial prejudice. I said it was the wrong thing to do, and I'm going to show you how to deal with it. But I don't think it was racial prejudice. His clientele at lunch comes from the collegiate school. They wear blue blazers, gold buttons. John F. Kennedy's kid went there. They leave big tips for his staff. And he knows the public school kids, black or white, go in there for lunch. He's going to lose that blue ribbon trade. Nevertheless, you're going to give him a chance to back down. This is an absolutely massive, insane Greek who believes violence is the solution to all problems. Once Jerry Mulligan, the famous jazz saxophonist, bounced a $10 check, he had it blown up to billboard size and mounted outside the restaurant. Okay, so I said, you go to the phone and I'll listen, and you say, I'm the guy whose pizza you took, but I'm willing to let bygones be bygones if I could. Nick hangs up on him. I said, I'm going to give you what in law is called an affidavit that you attempted to solve this problem peaceably. Now, I said, you want to go over there in person tomorrow, and I'll provide a long-distance witness, and you want to say, Look, it's just a slice of pizza. Give me my slice of pizza back. But Nick had the bit between out the kid goes. And now I said, you're going to call him one more time with a different teacher as a witness. Then you're going to write him a letter, certified, return receipt requested, 65 cents in those days. And now you have four pieces of evidence to provide to the court. And then you're going to sue his ass in small claims court. Only cost like $3 in those days. But it was 17 miles from the school. Kids can't sue. I said, anyone with $3 can sue. That doesn't mean you're going to win. But the way the referee in small claims court decides, since it's one person's, is who has evidence that they acted reasonably. And you will have four pieces of evidence, and this guy will be steam coming out of his ears. Well, he was awarded triple damages. How about that? Mm-hmm. Now, what do you suppose the small claims court referee said when he got home that night to his friend? You're not going to believe what I just adjudicated. So beginning about 4 days later, we get a call from the Brooklyn College Law School. Could he come over and lecture? Of course, he said no. And I said, listen, I'll ruin you if you don't. We'll work it out. Then Columbia Law School called. Then we got daily calls from judges to take him out to lunch, because isn't this a symbol that the system... Really? Okay. He's the only kid in 30 years of teaching that took my advice not to waste your time in high school. I said, any number of very good colleges will take you in at the end of your sophomore year if you provide the documentation. You're ready. He went to Duke, full tuition scholarship. Then Duke University Law School, and by the way, these two events, Strawberry Fields and Pizza Palace Suit, are from the same term in a junior high school. Just a few more of these things. Here's a PhD from UCal. Here's a 13-year-old girl who came to me complaining that her mother was a liar, said she could go to Paris alone that summer if she could raise the money. She said, I just checked, and nobody. I mean, she was a single-parent household. Mother was a secretary. She said, nobody. I said, well, you can't do it on a job, but there's not very much money if you have a little business. And she said, 13-year-old kids can't have businesses. I said, if you have something people want, they don't care how old you are. I mean, Sean Fanning almost ruined the music business with Napster. He was 17. So she takes a week out of school, figures out a really interesting exotic business that you can read my book and find out what it was, and raises enough money in a short time by cutting school for six consecutive weeks that she could afford to pay her mother's way to Paris. She came and said, I've got much more money than I need. I said, why don't you take your mother to Paris? She might appreciate it. On the basis of that, she went to what I believe is the finest college in the United States, Hampshire College, where you write your own curriculum and then you negotiate with the faculty. My granddaughter goes there, will be graduating next year. Hello, Christina. That's all I'll say. So,
what phrase in Icelandic means writing of God?
Yes. Well, it's her real name was, it's carried popularly as Gudrun, but she wasn't satisfied, so she went to court and changed it to Christina. So, hey, you know, what are you going to do?
If you could say something that would echo through time and each and every person from now until the end of humanity would hear it.
Yeah. Sensible children do not wish to be incomplete human beings. And so when you impose a stage theory of human development upon them, you affect or tormenting them, you're limiting their opportunities. The whole world for all history knew that childhood is over about the age of 7, and if it persists beyond the age of 12, you've got some hopeless human being on your mind. Don't be your kid's enemy, because they're not a kid. That's a fellow human being, male or female. Be their partner and enlarge the opportunities. No homework, please.
What does a college education really get you in the 21st century?
I think it's consistently given less and less. It essentially was the last hoop to jump through, but it never delivered much to most of the people who jumped through that hoop. It is possible, if you understand that an education is something you have to take, to use the resources that are assembled there and actually stitch together an education for yourself and get some value. But most people, of course, follow a prescribed plan which has been put together by a committee somewhere, and in fact doesn't do much for most people. I went to Cornell, Columbia, and Reed College, and I can guarantee from Cornell and Columbia, I remember nothing except the babes, the alcohol, hangovers, etc. From Reed, I got a little bit out of a Plato seminar that I do remember, basically arguing with the professor who encouraged that. You know, it doesn't give you a bang for your buck unless you commit. Which, who does? Isn't it supposed to produce a certificate that certifies you as eligible? The funny thing is that IT has accidentally exploded a lot of that, because so many people, I remember my daughter graduated from MIT, and she used to bitterly complain that her classmates would vanish for months at a time doing jobs for various companies, then come back as if nothing had happened and nobody punished them. you know, sorry to say that we were so slow picking up on, you judge people by performance, not by credentials. And real people, you'd be insane to hire on the basis of credentials, because the skew between memory and application is so large that eventually you're top heavy with people who don't know how to do anything much.
I'm going to ask this last question. I'm going to go burn your DVD. That way you're not late. And so just answer to Jitu and Tony and Kevin. What is the value of persistence as juxtaposed to the learning process?
About 10 years ago, I set up, I helped to set up a foundation that at Edison High School in New Jersey awards $10,000 a year to the most persistent student in the class. And persistence in the face of adversity is the final test. If you can stick to something, nothing is difficult to learn. I mean, nothing at all. But the natural selection process, operating on a low boredom quotient, on personal disrespect, I can't do that, and many other things, eliminates almost everyone except the persistent. Those are the ones who demonstrate merit. Now, obviously, a lot of the control mechanism is inherited or appointed, but the parts that aren't go to the persistent. And that includes the arts and the sciences as well as politics. I mean, who could imagine, for example, that an obviously inferior human being, I'm not speaking politically here, like George W. Bush, could pass through all the screens on the way up and then be elected not once but twice by the American population. He flunked his pilot's course, 25 out of 100, and now he's supposed to be given a jet to fly in combat. But of course, he pulled strings. He didn't do that. He clearly was an imbecile. He looked like an imbecile. He talked like an imbecile. And you cannot believe that any decisions attributed to him were actually made by him. No one would be crazy enough to put him in charge and say, you mind the store and I'll go off. So, but he was persistent, and he did reject the negative assessments that occurred all through his life. What Iraq is about, in my opinion, is showing Daddy that the people who embarrassed Daddy got their comeuppance, and who the hell cares that the carnage is? That is one of the great mass murderers in history. But Daddy's reputation was saved from disgrace.
What do you feel the role of UNESCO has been in the manipulation of the educational
curriculum? Well, I'm bothered a little bit by the general mass of conspiracy literature attributes powers to the United Nations, which it simply doesn't have. That doesn't mean that it isn't filled with villainous intentions. I mean that it never succeeded in becoming. People say it's a respectable institution, but they don't behave. No one says, what does the UN say about? No one says that. Mm-hmm. You know, and they've almost given up trying. I mean, there's now a minority opinion that it's not worth spending the money to have it in the United States, mm-hmm. You know, because it's as much anti-American as it carries out our subtler designs.
I've noticed that UNESCO focuses a lot of their workings on the educational
network
of nations, and you go to the
but you and I would too.
Pestalozzi and Herbart and Wundt are all listed.
Yeah, of course. Well, wouldn't anyone say it's easier to deal with unformed minds with no experience? Wean them away. It's in an engineering sense what you would expect to happen, and so we wouldn't be surprised that that's what does happen.
Who was Johann Pestalozzi, and what were some of his few ideas?
The most intriguing thing about the followers of Pestalozzi are that they never count the fact that every single one of his projects quickly failed. Every single one of them. What he had that was intriguing to the Prussian hierarchy and really the global hierarchy was that his method of kindness, and it may have been sincere, his method of kindness was a new weapon in the arsenal of, instead of whipping the poor, threatening them, menacing them, tormenting them, you killed them with kindness. The written principles of the Fabians are pestilotian, you know, by extending this blanket of kindness to people. It's still effective in that, you know, a big fraction of the American population expects charity and sees it as a blessing. Now, it's not hard to see why on this day or that day it could be a blessing, but overall, that you get weaker and weaker, like your arm gets weaker if it doesn't lift stuff above your head. I mean, it's such a fundamental principle of human physics, including mental physics, that to pull the wool over so many people's eyes.
I got your disc. It's got all the transcripts from your Gnostic media interviews, Jung's definition of liberal, and some Gordon Wasson
information
for it. You also talked about the cruise to open up
excellent.
And this is
excellent.
This is Taft's on the... It's Roosevelt's daughter. Roosevelt's president. Taft goes with her, and they open up... They go back to Japan after... who is the admiral that you mentioned that went over there?
Not Dewey.
But you know what I'm saying? They had already gone over there, and this was the second one, and then this sets up the whole World War II, World War I, the whole scenario, the opium smuggling, it's all in there. And this guy wrote Flags of Our Fathers and Flyboys.
Oh, yes.
James Bradley.
Yes.
And so I thought you might...
Thank you. I will.
You'll enjoy it. You did an outstanding job.
Hey, I this has been a lovely course in how complicated it is, you know, to make a...
To get the word out. Have you seen this book? No. It's called The Perfectibilist. It's by Terry Mullinson.
No.
That was the name of the Illuminati before it was known as the Illuminati. It was the Perfectibilists, and they were a private club. And this means... Per me, caci vident means through me, the blind become sighted. So their top secret is the trivium and learning, but they use it out of order, so they don't establish what exists first. They assert logic without...
No.
If you look in the back, it has a full glossary of individuals.
All members.
He's cataloged. Now, this is my copy, but I want you to take it, and I can get another one.
Oh,
and then you can
God bless.
Chris Milligan.
And God bless.
This here is the reference of Carl Wundt. And it goes into some of his colleagues, and you'll have a lot of references to your own material.
Thank you all, and certainly...
Now you got a heavy bag to carry.
Now I got a heavy bag to carry.
I'll take it for you. Good. Let me get your mic off, yeah?
Yes.
You've now experienced the first step of the ultimate history lesson. We've done the hard work of organizing the facts, and now it's up to you to think, learn, communicate, and take action among yourselves. But we don't expect you to do this alone, and in fact, since this message applies to all of us, it's truly a circumstance which unites us and makes us indivisible, so that we might deliver freedom and justice, not just to ourselves, but to people around the world. If there is a point to all of this, it might be in realizing that the system isn't broken. It was built this way. On purpose. It serves those who created it, not those who are managed by it. As a result, our potential as human beings has been undermined. Our birthright has been stolen, and our adolescent period of life has been extended indefinitely. We have been numbed to these facts, which have been obscured further by the 15,000 hours of public schooling, which is mandatory in order to earn the right to live and work in our civilized culture. We have been under the impression that public schooling was about educating us as a measure to prepare us for life, but those assumptions were formed based upon information supplied to us by our natural predators, who may dress and speak like us, but in their minds, intentions, and actions, they hold us in contempt. They manage us like livestock, and they poison us both figuratively and literally, as if we were pests. Each of us has a choice to make, and the question is, what is most important to us? Is it the products which money buys, or is it having a safe, happy, and healthy family? Unfortunately, it doesn't seem that we can have both in this culture. We must choose to either put our full support behind that which is most important to us, or face losing everything. I made that choice 8 years ago, and through the help of some friends, I transformed the materials around me into the resources which have delivered this message to you. In the minutes before Patrick Henry spoke into existence the phrase, "Give me liberty or give me death," in his speech to the Second Virginia Convention on March 23, 1775, he first addressed the convention's president, Peyton Randolph of Williamsburg. Quote, "For my own part, I consider it as nothing less than a question of freedom or slavery, and in proportion to the magnitude of the subject, ought to be the freedom of debate. It is only in this way that we can hope to arrive at truth and to fulfill the great responsibility which we hold to God and country. Should I keep back my opinions at such a time, through fear of giving offense, I should consider myself guilty of treason towards my country, and an act of disloyalty toward the majesty of heaven, which I revere above all earthly kings. Mr. President, it is natural to man to indulge in the illusions of hope. We are apt to shut our eyes against painful truth and listen to the song of that siren until she transforms us into beasts. Is this the part of wise men engaged in a great and arduous struggle for liberty? Are we disposed to being of the number of those having eyes, see not, and having ears, hear not, the things which so nearly concern their temporal salvation? For my part, whatever anguish of spirit it may cost, I am willing to know the whole truth, to know the worst, and to provide for it." End quote. So, if you realize that your family and or community was in danger, how would you make them aware of it as a measure to protect them from the peril? Well, once you meet and surmount the mental obstacles by employing your use of reason, it would then be logical to organize the facts, connect and communicate with your loved ones and community, to learn together how to dispel confusion, how to take informed constructive actions, and when you meet resistance, how to learn your way forward. It doesn't benefit anyone to continue to sanitize the world for our youth, as it prevents them from developing a strong immune system and thereby undermines their chances of survival in this world. To that end, as I mentioned in the introduction, we've also created the UltimateHistoryLesson.com, which specifically hosts the YouTube version of this interview in video form, as well as the MP3 versions for your downloading pleasure, as well as the transcript, references, notes, links, primary source materials, and every other piece of media associated with this interview set, all with the goal of helping you to understand. And while this all might sound like a good idea, most people need a little help outgrowing the habits which enable us to be so easily manipulated. In order to help each and every individual tap into their internal natural resources, we created TragedyandHope.com, which acts as a next step for those who seek to learn more after screening our productions. Now that you've heard John talk about the book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time by Dr. Carol Quigley, you'll indeed appreciate the fact that we've created an international network of independent media producers, all of whom consistently provide educational films, podcasts, and video reports, commercial-free and free to the public. With over 1,400 people from all over the world posting videos, posting blogs, forming study and research groups, and learning the arts of intellectual self-defense and strategic problem solving, we have built a truly unique experience which has thus far been denied to the general public, and it is in every way designed to help you realize your birthright. In this last hour, I was surprised to learn about John's key role in helping Yoko Ono get approval to create Strawberry Fields, a section of Central Park in New York dedicated to John Lennon, across the street from where he was shot in front of the Dakota Hotel. We've done a lot since creating Tragedy and Hope in 2009, so let me share a bit of synchronicity about how all this began. These are the last few pages of the premiere issue of our interactive magazine before it evolved into an interactive community of critical thinkers. I'd say that not only have we come a long way, but we've also stayed on track, and I think that's reflected in the synchronicity of these full circle moments. We're serious about studying the big problems, identifying the root causes, and enacting constructive solutions. And we sure could use your help. And in return, we'll help you catch up on what you've been missing. We must ask the questions. Can we have peace without understanding the root causes of war? Can we have liberty without the responsibility and reason incorporated into our actions to bring it about? Why aren't we preparing our children for their lives? Why doesn't public schooling prepare us for the fact that we are entering a world where there are predators and systems of predation to be avoided? And in learning the answers, we found that it's due to the fact that the predators designed the public schooling system. It's time to reclaim our birthright, and this interview is aimed at delivering it to you. What you do with it is your choice. Figure out how to teach yourself anything by asking substantial questions and identifying valid answers. Help us create a network of affiliates and continue to spread this message of self-liberation. By understanding the problems, the solutions become known. The truth is the future, and we want to see what the world looks like when you develop the habits which reveal your inner potential. Last but not least, learn how to use the active literacies to liberate yourself and share what you've learned with others. Because the world is made up of words, and if you know the right words, you can make of the world what you will. Go and do likewise. Be persistent. Refuse to give your consent to irrationality, and realize that in your heart and mind, that we are only victims until we mature and take responsibility for our thoughts and actions. And to that end, keep learning, keep moving forward. Thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.